Software Engineering Radio, episode 106, Introduction to Aspect-Oriented Programming.
This is Software Engineering Radio, the podcast for professional developers, on the web at se-radio.net. SE Radio brings you relevant and detailed discussions and interviews on software engineering topics every 10 days. Thanks to our audience and the partners listed on our website for supporting the podcast.
In contrast to some other episodes, we have two women and only one male person on this episode. And there is another specialty, and that is that we have two Austrians and only one non-Austrian. So we have, this is very special. Apart from that, we're going to talk about aspect orientation, aspect-oriented software development.
A very female thing.
Why?
Because there are a lot more women dealing with this topic than men, I think.
Yeah, that's probably interesting. If you look at the...
Or at least the percentage of women is higher than for, you know, other topics in computer science currently.
Yeah. I noticed that. I just wondered why this is the case. But listeners, in case you wonder whose voice this was, so this was Christa Schwanninger. Do you want to introduce yourself briefly?
My name is Christa Schwanning. I'm working for Siemens, and I'm doing a little research also in aspect-oriented software development. That's a topic we in our research team here are interested because of the implications on architecture this might have.
Okay. And the other voice you might have heard laughing in the beginning was Iris Grohr. So you maybe want to talk a little bit about you briefly.
Hi, my name is Iris Grohr, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Linz, and I'm working here at Siemens. I'm employed here as a PhD student, and the topic of my work is product line engineering in connection to aspect-oriented software development.
So both of you have quite some experience with aspects, and that's why we kind of assembled in that group today. Just before we get started, one more comment. We've had another episode where we interviewed Gregor Kichales, or whatever he, I don't know really how to pronounce his last name, Kichales, whatever. So that was more or less an overview, like opinions from the guru, whereas this episode is,
from the women.
Or opinion from the street.
Yeah, it's intended as a real introduction to the topic. So we try to step through AOSD systematically and not like we did last time. So if you haven't heard the Kisales interview yet, you should first listen to this one and then listen to the interview with Gregor. If we talk about aspect orientation, then people often talk about the separation of concerns. Do you want to explain a little bit what a concern is?
So a concern is anything somebody is interested in. Mm-hmm. A concern can be something the user of a system is interested in, something the developer is interested in, or something the person who's paying for software development is interested in.
If you talk about AOP, then people always talk about cross-cutting concerns. What's the cross-cutting thing about it?
A cross-cutting concern is a concern that cannot be easily cast into one entity in the solution space.
So it's not localizable.
It's not localizable. It's not per se because it's not possible to localize it as a concern possibly, but since there are some major concerns that typically are functional concerns that are mapped to the solution space first, and then there are some concerns, you know, that come after these major concerns.
Such as
security, persistency. Often they are non-functional concerns. Because typically you deal with the functional concerns first, and then you try to get in the non-functional concerns.
Yeah.
And those concerns then often cannot be modularized that well anymore because there is something already you did and you have there. And those concerns cross-cut the things that are there and therefore are hard to modularize. I don't say that you can't modularize, you know, security in some modules or subclasses like authentication
manager.
But nevertheless, the places where authentication plays a role in your software are many, and not only the authentication manager itself.
So you say even although you might be able to modularize the algorithm that manages the authentication, calling that algorithm is scattered through the system.
Yeah.
It sounds to me a little bit that that's a limitation of the underlying language. I mean, object orientation has this one decomposition hierarchy, also called, I think, the tyranny of the dominant decomposition. So is AOP to some extent a fix that tries to fix the shortcomings of object-oriented programming?
So I wouldn't say so. So that the tyranny of the dominant decomposition is just the fact that you start with some functional concerns you want to modularize, and then you start decomposing them in some way, in an object-oriented way, for example, and then some other concerns arise, or there are often non-functional concerns you want to modularize in addition, and then those do not fit well into the decomposition you have chosen from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are special effects called scattering and tangling.
Yeah, can you explain what the difference between those are? I always mix them up.
So scattering is when one concern is implemented in several modules. So the implementation of this one concern, the cross-cutting concern, is scattered over many places of your object-oriented hierarchy, for example. So entangling means that in one module of your hierarchy, one module of your hierarchy basically implements more than one concern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's more or less the same, but looked at from a different point of view,
right. Uh-huh.
Either from the concern or from, you know, one other well-modularized thing in your solution space.
Okay, so I think we agree that the whole point of AOP and aspect-oriented software development is to come to the rescue here to help us get out of this problem. So. Can you maybe very briefly, like in two or three sentences, say what aspects do and what they are, and then we can look at the different like buzzwords, join point, point cut, and all that stuff.
So an aspect is just a module, like a class, but that has a special purpose, and its purpose is to modularize those so-called cross-cutting concerns. And an aspect can contain, like a class, can contain members and operations, but special kinds of things such as point cuts and advices.
Okay. So let's maybe define those terms and explain what they mean.
First, we probably have to explain that, you know, when you modularize a cross-cutting concern, that doesn't mean it's not cross-cutting anymore. The concern per se still cross-cuts the rest of your system.
Yeah.
And that's why we need some special, you know, means to make these aspects happen. And those means are, for example, point cuts that help you defining where in your source code this cross-cutting concerns interacts with the rest of the system.
So with a base program, it's called, I think.
Yeah, you can say base program or
primary concerns.
Since it still is cross-cutting, you have to specify those points where it cross-cuts the rest of the system, and that's where this point cuts come in.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to specify a point cut, you first need a concept of those points in your system you want to interact with. That's called a join point.
So let me briefly try to say that in different words. In some sense, I think a point cut is a query over a running program.
Exactly. You say you have some points in your program you're interested in that are called join points, so points where you join in the aspect, and the point cut picks all the points you're interested in for one specific concern or one specific part of a concern.
Okay. So the other two terms are advice then and the aspect itself.
So the aspect itself is the module, and the module captures own members or operations, but also point cuts and advices. And the point cuts, as we already said, select the points where you want to add additional functionality.
Yep.
And this additional functionality is then defined in the advice. So that's the additional things you want to execute at those points.
So it's a piece of code, a piece of behavior that you apply to the base program at places that are selected by the point cut.
That's right, yeah. So in a language that's not aspect-oriented, the position of the statement normally determines when it's executed.
Yeah.
But in an aspect-oriented language, this is a bit different because in the module you define external to your base code where things should happen and what should happen at those points.
Critics often say that to some extent AOP is just a way of tweaking code. Like you can do like bytecode manipulation in Java, but what you really do in really good aspect languages is that you don't specify where something should happen, but rather when. So a join point is basically a piece or a place in the execution of a program, not a source code location. Is that a relevant distinction, or is that more or less picky?
No, that's absolutely relevant, this distinction, because you're not interested in, you know, changing your source code to some extent, but you're interested in points in the control flow on the runtime of your program where certain conditions are true, and you want to be, you know, as specific what these conditions are as possible. Mm-hmm. So typically in aspect-oriented language that are used nowadays, you use nevertheless lexical elements to specify those points.
So the program structure is a means of defining that point. Let's make that concrete. If you want something to happen after another method has executed, then this after method has executed is basically, that's a point in the execution. But a way of implementing that thing is to do something in the code after the method has been called.
Exactly, exactly. And the more powerful your point cut language is, the easier it is to find the logical points or to define the logical points in the control flow of your application where something should apply. Yeah. This can be anything from, you know, do something when a method is called up to do something when my program goes into a specific state, and the state is a very complicated thing that considers historical information in your application, data flow information on your application, whatever you can think of.
And we'll talk about this join point model and the point cuts later in more detail. But to finish this discussion about the basics of AOP, we already mentioned implicitly, something happens after, before, around. There are these different kinds of advice. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on those?
In the aspect-oriented language, aspect-j, that is maybe the most famous one, and it's an aspect-oriented language that is based on Java. There are three different kinds of advices. So there is the before advice, that's code that is executed before a point cut matches. Then there is the after advice, that is executed after a certain point cut matches, and there is the around advice. So the around advice can execute code before as well as after.
Or even instead.
Even instead, that's right.
Yeah. So, and of course, if you have an after advice, then you do have access to the return value, for example, if it's a method call. So if the join point, or so let's say if the point cut modifies the state of something, then of course in an after advice you have access to that changed state.
Yeah, you can have access to the whole context, basically. Yeah.
Okay, so then let's look at a couple of typical examples for using aspect-oriented programming. And there is the general ubiquitous example of logging, I guess. And then there is hopefully more useful stuff. So do you want to provide a couple of examples?
Yeah, so logging is the typical hello world example, like for objects, GUI objects were the, you know, starting point for object-oriented programming. Everybody could imagine that a window and a button is an object. People had hard time to see that something like a symbol in a compiler could be an object. Mm-hmm. So this changed in the last 20 years, I think. Still, AO is in a stage where a lot of people think, you know, logging is what you can do with aspect orientation, but that's definitely not the case.
So why is it that logging is this hello world? What's so simple about logging that it's this kind of introductory example?
If you do logging really simple without thinking about it, you could do something like, you know, at every like tracing at every entrance or exit of a method, you write, I entered this method and I now leave this method again. For real logging problems, this would be a lot too simplistic, and we already had cases where we said, no, we don't want to use aspect J for logging, because if you want to have meaningful outputs for logging, you rather, you know, write the logging statement dedicated to the point where you want to log.
So, because that's the point. If you do it with an aspect, what you do is, of course, you factor out the logging functionality, system out print line something, into the aspect. And then, of course, this aspect needs to be generic in some way so that you can reattach it to all these different points.
Yeah, and we had, for example, one thing in an application we wrote where we first wanted to use aspects for logging, we had the problem that, you know, the logging output is not meaningful at all because you're not interested in, you know, method exits and entrances, but you're interested in, you know, something is accomplished now, some meaningful message. Yeah, yeah. And then you write an aspect where, you know, you probably the only thing you really encapsulate there is the fact that you do logging somewhere.
Yeah.
But for
yeah.
every point in your source code, you'd have a different advice because the message you want to print is different. So logging is definitely not a very good example for an aspect. Right. Really, tracing is different. Tracing where you only want to know, or profiling or something like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, collecting execution data.
Yeah, that, yeah. there it's perfect, yeah. of course.
So, and the trick is, of course, that if you have an aspect, then, or if you write an advice, I should say, then you do have information to some meta characteristics. So you maybe you know you can ask the join point. So the join point object is typically represented as an object in the advice. So you can query it. What's the name of the method I'm just entering?
Yeah.
So you have access to the meta level to some extent.
You of course have information about the environment of the point you trapped.
Yeah,
let's say it that way.
Yeah, it's a good term, trapping, by the way.
Yeah.
No, people know this from other IT areas. A trap is something that fires if something happens.
Yeah.
So it's a good analogy.
And there you can get the information about the calling object, typically about the caller, about parameters. So if everything you might be interested in that is relevant for this one point. And then you, of course, can do things with those. You can change parameters.
Mm-hmm.
You can call other methods from one of the two,
mm-hmm.
from the caller or the callee,
mm-hmm.
Whatever is necessary at that point.
Okay, so if logging is not a good example and tracing is very simplistic, what then? What else can we say about typical examples for AOP? People often talk about technical versus functional concerns.
So that's true. So it's often the case that technical concerns are implemented as aspects.
What is a technical concern?
Basically, a non-functional concern.
What is a non-functional concern?
A non-functional concern that is something that's not related to the business domain.
Okay.
And that doesn't implement business functionality. So examples include security, persistence, caching, for example, or also consistent error handling is something that's often implemented
mm-hmm.
as an aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, of course, also possible to use aspects to implement business concerns. But to find a good example is always hard, because it's as hard to find a good example for a business aspect as to find one typical example for a business object.
Yeah.
So
it's also funny, for example, one I think cross-cutting business aspect could be billing.
Yes.
So you somehow look at the resources a specific method works with, for example, some kind of whatever, an MP3 file that you download, whatever, and then you can weave the billing concern in. But the funny thing is that I have the impression that as soon as things are cross-cutting, people say, oh, well, but that's not really business logic. That's more or less technical in our domain.
So we once implemented a demonstrator that was about a topological tree.
Mm-hmm.
And we've implemented the error propagation
what
as an aspect.
What is a topological tree?
So that's basically a tree of hardware nodes.
Oh, hardware topology.
So
okay.
Yeah, right. So if one node fails, for example, or reports an error, so this error is then propagated to top nodes.
Yep.
And the propagation strategy was something that we implemented as an aspect, for example, and we
mm-hmm.
could then easily exchange between different propagation strategies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's obviously
an example
business.
Of business, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing here is, again, that when you think of typical aspects, then you think of things that have been modularized, or people tried to modularize before, because they very often had the problem that they had a concern that should not pollute the rest of the system.
Yeah.
When we look at, you know, for example, J2E component containers,
yes,
or
yes.
other component containers,
yes.
or even at Corba, there are this.
Yeah.
services there.
Interceptors and also, right?
Interceptors, yeah. There were things that, you know, always polluted business objects. They were
yep.
needed a lot. So I like the distinction between an application domain and a software domain. Jan Bosch made this in one of his books, and the application domain has to do with your business,
yeah.
while the software domain is something that's in the solution space, and we deal with such software domains like persistency and databases, like
yeah.
user interfaces, in so many different domains
yeah.
that we know how to handle them, and we know how to, you know, handle persistency, and therefore it's possible, or it was possible in component containers already,
yes.
to implement them in a way such that they can be reused for most business applications, for example.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because some people say, well, but interceptors, you know, like AOP on framework level isn't really AOP because it has been there all the time, and that's not really what we want to do.
The problem was there all the time. Yeah. So it would be sad if AOP would have to invent its own problems. But the problem of those cross-cutting concerns that happened to be those software concerns is there for long, and people had to solve it.
Yeah.
And to make, you know, infrastructure and business code reusable, they had to be dragged out into their own modules that were happened then to be services in that container, which is good and great, and nobody needs to call this aspect-oriented programming.
Yeah, as long as it's useful.
As long as it's useful. I mean, AOP has some advantages above this, since there is, of course, some overhead when you have a container and you intercept something, and then you look up what concerns or what services should be applied at that point. This all takes time. If you could handle this with an aspect that's woven at compile time, then a lot of runtime overhead goes away.
Yeah. To some extent, you could say that that's an implementation detail.
That's an implementation detail. Yeah.
We'll talk about these details later, by the way.
Yeah, on the other hand, I mean, it's simply the concept. So nobody would modularize something only, you know, one business case needs in a component container. Yeah. So you couldn't buy such a component container that offers you such a concern.
So
if it's
all
not
about,
used.
About economics. Only it's things that are used all over the place would be factored out into a container.
Exactly, exactly. And with aspects, you simply identify the things on your own and implement them as aspects and have all these mechanisms at hand that let you easily bring them together with your base code.
Mm-hmm. Very good point, yeah. I think the next thing we need to discuss is the join point model. So it's basically the granularity of where you can trap the program, right? So it seems like the finer the join point model, the more you can do with your aspect language. So the join point model seems very important.
Yeah, the join point model is basically defines what you can do with this aspect-oriented language. So there are different approaches. So there are approaches that only allow you to basically intercept the public interfaces of some components. But there are also languages that allow you to do very fine-grained manipulation. So it depends on your needs. So the more fine-grained your join point model is, the more you can do with it, but the more you can do wrong, of course, as well.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that there are like the typical classical interceptor frameworks, such as CORBA, where you can only, if a component is invoked, you can basically intercept that invocation. So how does AspectJ go further than that? I mean, what kind of additional, more fine-grained join points do you have there?
So in AspectJ, there is also something we didn't talk about yet, that's introductions. Yep. So what you also can do in AspectJ is you can introduce new members or new operations into existing classes, and you can even change the class hierarchy.
Change a new superclass or something.
Right, so you can make classes implement certain interfaces, and you can extend classes from others, have classes extend from others that didn't do it before. Mm-hmm. So that's called static cross-cutting.
Okay, because it happens, it changes the structure. It really changes the structure of your code. It's not just changing the code to simulate intercepting some point in the execution. It really changes the code.
That's right. So it really changes the code. And the dynamic things you can do in AspectJ, for example, you can... there are different join points such as method calls or method execution.
So what's the difference between the execution and the call join point?
So the difference is the context. So in a call join point, you're at the caller side. So you have access to the context of the caller.
So who calls a method?
Who calls a method, right. And with the execution join point, it's different. So you're then at the callee side. So you have access to the context of the one that's been called.
Okay. So that's interesting, because if you have the classical interceptor-based thing, then you typically know... It's basically an execution point cut. It's not so easy to find out about the callee of a program, because the typical interceptor doesn't know where the object comes from, because you don't have that meta information at the point where you call, if you do classical interceptors.
That's right. So in AspectJ, you've got both things available.
Mm-hmm. There is other thing like object creation, object destruction, variable assignment, right?
That's right. So you can also define point cuts that select certain constructor calls, or also read accesses to certain variables, mm-hmm. or write accesses to certain variables.
Is that useful?
I mean, I wonder whether it's good practice to fiddle around with a running program on that low level of detail, or whether you shouldn't say that you know, like you want to restrict the interception that an aspect does on more architectural levels, such as method calls, method execution.
It depends a lot on what you want to do, of mm-hmm. course. For many systems, it might be okay to tackle the problem on the interface level, you know, only being able to intercept public interfaces, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. But depending on the cross-cutting concerns you need to modularize, it might make sense to be more invasive. Mm-hmm. You have to think of the problem as being, you know, the cross-cutting concern is in the source code. Mm. And even if you don't modularize it, it's still there. And, you know, there is a nice article by Gregor Kisalis and Miro Messini who talk about breaking encapsulation, you know.
Yeah, that's one of these what people criticize. It breaks all the nicely done encapsulation by hacking around in details.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if the cross-cutting concern has to be implemented, because it's tangled with your base concern, then it is simply there, and it breaks encapsulation. And why not modularize it and make it obvious that it is there? It might be that you want to change it, and fiddling around in the code of your base concern to change the cross-cutting concern is not easy either. Mm. So rather have it modularized and have it easily changeable. Mm-hmm. If you need this. If you don't need it, if you write a program and you never touch it afterwards again, it probably is not, you know, you don't care. Unless it runs and does what it should, you don't care about modularization at all. Only if you want to evolve it, if you want to understand it later on, then you care about those things.
It's a very good point. So the motivation for AOP is the ability to be able to reuse either the base program because it's now free of technical crap, or the aspects, because you want to be able to apply them to different program-based programs.
This can be one concern why you do it. You can have other concerns.
Such as?
You can say you want to, you know, evolve it and understand it better, what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not only reuse it, but, you know, only use it in the context you have it, but be able to change it when you need to change it, for example. Or you could have something like a cross-cutting concern in a product family that varies, and then you want to have two variations of this one concern, and you don't want to have, you know, two variations of 10 classes only because this concern goes through those 10 classes, but you'd rather have two aspects, and then you exchange them when you have to vary.
Also, instead of having all kinds of if-defs in the code, or if this variant, then else this variant, that, then you can have different aspects, one per variant, and either weave the one or weave the other.
2 days ago, we had a visitor from the University of Erlangen, Olaf Spinzig, who showed an example of the ECOS operating system. And there is this operating system is highly configurable. It's more or less an operating system family. And he showed one function there, so it's implemented in C++ or in C even. There is a lot of conditional compilation in it. And every, you know, there are a lot of cross-cutting concerns. He showed one example of a method, and I think the method had 23 lines of code. Only 2 lines of the code were the business concerns, and the rest were cross-cutting concerns, all with, you know, this nice if-defs. Having such a thing modularized, really, with aspects, in this example, it's Aspect C++.
Yeah, so Olaf Spinzig is the developer of Aspect
Olaf
C++.
Olaf Spinzig is the developer of, I don't know, he not alone. But
yeah, but he's kind of the guy.
He's kind of the guy who is leading this development.
Yeah.
And it looks a lot nicer if you can have those things modularized.
Yeah.
You won't understand the base code with all the if-defs.
Yeah.
Easily, and it's a lot easier to have this aspect.
So aspect-oriented product line engineering sounds like an interesting research topic.
Definitely, we should do something along that line.
So there is another point cut that I always found a little bit hard to understand in the beginning, and it's called flow, see flow below. What's that stuff?
So this point cut more or less takes the stack into account. So you can express something like, I want to do something at that point when some other method from some arbitrary other object was called before. So I look at the stack when the other method was called before and I'm in the control flow of this other method, I want to do something.
So that's really dynamic. That's not something you can easily do with static code weaving. You really need to look during the runtime of the program, is this other method or this other whatever method, yeah, typically in the call stack of the current execution path.
Right. That's really you dynamically find out if this condition holds. There are other things you can do with AspectJ that can question other things dynamically, but Cflow is one typical thing you want to see. There are other things like data flow join points, for example, in other languages that consider a data item when the data item was the same data item was processed or the same object.
And you might also be able to maybe set like traps on if a specific variable gets that value, then.
Yeah, probably like this, or if a specific variable was operated on with some other operation before, or things like this. So you can do a whole lot of things. There are research languages, like Alpha is one of those research languages, that consider everything, that do a data flow and control flow analysis before the program runs. And then you even can take things into account that predict what could happen at some future time, seen from the point of time you are in your program then do something, bringing together all the information you possibly can have about your program and could have calculated before or at runtime. So that's an experimental language that's definitely not very runtime efficient.
Yes.
But it gives a lot of room for experimenting with join point models and with those kinds of point cuts.
Okay, so I think there is another term we need to discuss, and that is symmetric versus asymmetric AOP.
We often talked about today about a base program and an aspect, and that's basically what asymmetric AO is all about.
So there's one dedicated base program.
There is one dedicated mainly object-oriented base program and an aspect that cross-cuts many places of your object-oriented hierarchy. So AspectJ is a very famous example of a language that's an asymmetric AO language. And symmetric languages work different, so they implement all concerns in separation, no matter if they are cross-cutting or not. And at the end, they get composed together. So HyperJ was a very famous example.
You say was, is it still around?
So it's not developed currently. I think they stopped it. Yeah. So they started a project called CME, Concern Manipulation Environment.
Which is also not very much
I think
heard
so,
of.
Yeah.
So one could argue that the asymmetric AOP has kind of won.
Well, I think it's much easier to start with because the symmetric thing requires a whole new way of thinking. So you've developed software when you develop software in an object-oriented way, you still do it when you use asymmetric AO languages. You just encapsulate your cross-cutting concerns as aspects and weave them back in. But if you use a symmetric language, you have to think in a completely different way. So you have to develop all your concerns completely in isolation and really think about how to compose them.
Such a much more radical approach in some
sense.
Yeah,
that's true.
Since we're already talking about the terminology, there is another pair of words, which is a heterogeneous aspect versus homogeneous aspect.
When you think of logging, for example, which is a bad example we already talked of, so let's say tracing, you do the same thing all over again. You more or less, when you write an aspect, can live with one or two advices and then nevertheless target 1,000 points in your program. And you do always the same thing, that is printing out the method name and the parameters. So this is quite homogeneous, I'd say. So if you do the same thing at many places, that's homogeneous.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you can have other kinds of cross-cutting things. A very good example for explaining this is the subject-observer pattern.
Right.
So you have several subjects probably in your object graph, and you have, let's say, one observer. The logic of the observer and the logic of the subjects that would be added by the aspects is not the same. So mm-hmm. it's heterogeneous.
Yeah. So you have to do two different things. Advise the observer and advise the subject.
The subject with different logic
right.
to make
yeah.
this protocol
yeah.
happen.
Yeah.
And that's called then a heterogeneous aspect.
Because
and
it changes two different places with different advice.
Not to say that there can't be, you know, 1,000 different classes that play the subject, but
mm-hmm.
nevertheless,
mm-hmm.
you have differentiation of things you do, different things at different
yeah.
places.
I get the impression that many of the typical technical concerns we talked about are probably homogeneous, and they can easily be factored into a library and applied to all kinds of systems, whereas some of the more business-oriented functional aspects are probably more heterogeneous.
Probably. I myself would say I don't have enough experience with this because I can
mm-hmm.
probably think of very homogeneous business concerns and
yeah.
of very heterogeneous infrastructure concerns.
So it feels right, but we can't prove it.
It feels right, but we can't prove it
yeah.
yet.
Yeah.
Probably in 5 years.
Okay.
We can get a proper answer to this.
Okay. Before we go to the implementation technologies, I think one of the hallmarks of AOP is this thing called quantification, which is this query that selects a number of points to do something, which then goes back to this more or less homogeneous thing. So I've heard people say that that is the difference to some of the other code tweaking approaches, but that only a remark. So let's look at implementation technologies for AOP. That P is important. We'll see why this is important in a minute. So there are different ways of how this interception of program behavior can actually be made to work.
So in connection to AOP, you always talk about something that's called weaving.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
that's basically the mechanism how you bring things together again, because you separate your cross-cutting concern in an aspect, but you have to get it back in then again. And weaving can be done on different levels. And it's often called weaving even if it's not really weaving, because you can also generate a proxy, for example. But you could weave at different levels. So you could weave your source code. You could weave some intermediate code, such as the bytecode, Java bytecode, for example. You could also weave your binaries.
Mm-hmm.
There are some research projects that, for example, bring AO even into the VM. So
mm-hmm.
the VM is supporting
yeah.
AO then.
So, but all of these approaches you just mentioned are what you'd call static weaving, because some artifact, bytecode, machine code, source code, is actually changed.
That's true, but when the VM, for example, supports it, it's definitely dynamic.
So, but in addition to these static possibilities, there are also other ways. For example, I know that Smalltalk, if you talk to Smalltalkers, they think sometimes, you know, aspect orientation isn't really special because they've had more or less meta object protocols for ages. And they could change the meta class to implement before and after behavior. The same is true for CLOS, for example, the Lisp object system, or even today in Ruby, where you can do a lot of these things with meta programming. So there is no changing of code in the sense that code is manipulated, but rather you change the runtime system in some sense.
That's also where ASD came from, with Gregor Kitalis first
right.
working on meta object protocols. The thing there is, you know, you can do so many things, and it's not easy to wrap your mind around those languages
yeah.
and changing more or less your language at runtime is not what the average programmer does every day.
Well, except if you're a Ruby programmer.
Yeah, probably, but not every programmer is a Ruby programmer.
Yes.
So there are still, you know, programmers that program in COBOL today, and they do not change the languages usually.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is an aspect COBOL, but nevertheless, this aspect languages try to bring this, changes, these cross-cutting concerns in as, you know, a deliberate programming model that helps you model solving
right.
a problem,
yeah.
modularizing
yeah.
a cross-cutting concern,
yeah.
and not changing your program at runtime or whatever things you might want to do. It's
yeah.
dedicated for this one purpose,
yeah.
for this one area of problems that's out there.
Yeah. So that's a good point, because people could say, why do you need aspect day? For example, I could use what is it called, bytecode engineering library, so tweak with a bytecode directly. But AOP gives you a well-defined programming model for tweaking the bytecode
exactly.
and not just a toolkit.
I mean, you can use whatever. You can solve probably any problem with any technology yes. And fiddling around yeah. with whatever fancy stuff you can think of. The thing is that that's not the way the majority of software developers want to program and yeah. want to think. If you want to think in, you know, base concerns and cross-cutting concerns right away, when having an architecture and a design in mind, you probably don't then want to think in some bytecode manipulations later on, but yeah. rather in some language constructs yeah. with which you can develop yeah. what you have in mind. Yeah.
There's also load time weaving. So what's happening? I think it's Java specific.
Load time weaving you can do with every language that loads bytecode, and you can manipulate this bytecode mm-hmm. either. So to be specific about this, Java does not, AspectJ does not manipulate the Java source code, but the Java bytecode. Mm-hmm. And you need not do this, you know, for all the bytecode at compile
advance,
time,
yeah.
but you could do this at load time of each class.
Lazily, kind of.
Lazily. And for some approaches like JBoss AOP, it's quite natural to weave in stuff at load time and then make use of, you know, changing aspects also at runtime. So that's also possible with some approaches like JBoss AOP. It can, on the one hand, be a means to make the compile cycles shorter, mm-hmm. like for yeah. AspectJ, or on the other hand, a mean to be more dynamic, more or less, not to decide mm-hmm. in advance what aspects should influence your base code.
Another way of implementing that stuff is then also probably the proxy and interceptor patterns, if you want to go that far. So if you have an object that you want to have aspects applied to or applied on, then you can have a proxy for them. The proxy has a way to insert interceptors, and then when you call on the proxy delegates to the interceptors. But that, of course, that's only very coarse-grained, because the only thing you can intercept is the public interface again.
That's, again, something that's done in Spring AOP, for example. So yeah. there's an implementation for Java, and there's an implementation for .NET mm-hmm. Using this. And there is also an implementation done by Microsoft people, by the Patterns and Practices group in mm-hmm. Microsoft,
okay.
that implemented such a framework. We would call it AOP framework. They say policy injection application block.
Yeah, well, because they at some point politically decided that they don't AOP, right?
More or less, or they want to be, you know, they say that's an early step in that direction, uh-huh. and they don't want to give the impression that this is a fully fledged AOP.
Okay.
So it's a transparent proxy approach. So
yeah.
every object you want to intercept, you have to create using a factory, mm-hmm. and then there is in between this proxy and the original object, a series of handlers, mm-hmm. and if each of these handlers implements a cross-cutting concern, yeah. if you want.
Yeah, the handler is kind of the interceptor in the other terminology.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so let's look a little bit at the practical experience of working with the aspects. One thing I think is that what the AOP community talks about quite a bit is that you can apply aspects after the fact. So you have your system, it's finished, it does something. And now after you've finished it, somebody comes up, oh, shit, we have to add this kind of other feature. So you can add additional features, functionalities after the system has been designed without changing the system. You just advise it. Is that realistic? Does that work?
I mean, it works, of course. You can do that.
Technically.
Yeah. The question is it good when you do this, more or less patching an existing system? I mean, we don't want to judge about people who are doing this for some reason, because there might be a reason for this. So you probably have a third-party library and
yeah.
you want to change something there
yeah.
and you use aspects for
the rest. You don't have the source code.
You don't have the source code. You have to patch something or, you know, things like this. So there can be valid reasons for doing this. But in general, that's not really a good practice to do this. I'd rather say that you treat aspects as, you know, first-class citizens, and when you see that there are cross-cutting concerns and you have a good reason for wanting this concern not implemented and tangled in your system, then you should use aspects to modularize it. On the other hand, we talked about product line. So if you have a cross-cutting feature, for example, and you want to have different variants of this feature, it makes a lot of sense to implement it in Aspects Plus if you have a product family. And 99% of your customers want to have the system, you know, in a specific way with only a few variations in it. And then there is this one customer who wants something completely different. You probably don't want to pollute the rest of your system, or, you know, for this one customer, build in another variation in some complicated way, but rather more or less patch the system for this one customer.
Yeah. But what you're saying is that in both of the cases you just mentioned, it's probably a good idea to think about aspects when building the system as opposed to hacking the system afterwards. So because that's my impression too. If you want to use aspects well, if you want to exploit their potential, then you need to think of them as you develop the system, as you design the system, just as you think of object, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best way to consider aspects. And of course, then AOP is not the end. So we should do something AOP-ish before implementing something. So if you want to think in aspects, we need aspects before programming.
Oh, that's a good point. So what would that be? I mean, well, it sounds obvious, aspects and analysis requirements, but what does it mean specifically?
So if you can implement aspects, then it would, of course, be nice to have a way at design time when you probably paint some UML diagrams to also be able to express that there is an aspect that interacts with the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. And when you can do this, then you need modeling languages that are more or less aspect aware so that you can design your aspects in architecture and design stage. And then, of course, when you want to think of aspects early, then at requirements analysis time, you should be aware of the concept of an aspect. You should not only have in mind that you want to end up with a clean object-oriented system, because that's what in requirements analysis, you more or less bundle up your requirements to form entities later on in your system.
Yep.
And to keep in mind that there are entities that can cross-cut other entities helps a lot if you then later on want to design and implement also aspects.
So is AO more of a mindset? So because people could say, you know, you can do AO with normal OO if you use proxies and interceptors and some of that stuff, but it's important to think AO so that you identify cross-cutting things and modularize them with whatever means your language gives you. So is AO thinking more important than AO programming or whatever?
I think it is, yeah. So I think it's very important to just be aware of the fact that there is something that's cross-cutting, that there is the effect that some concerns do not fit into the decomposition you have chosen, and that you try to handle them in a way that fits for your certain problem.
And as we all know, the language you use guides your thinking. So if you have a language that supports AO, then you might start thinking in AO. Whereas if you have just an OO language, it's not something that comes easy to think in aspects. So the point is that if you have an AO language, the chances that you think in AO are higher than if you have an OO language, although you could also do some AO-ish stuff in an OO language.
Yeah, that's true. So if you use a language such as AspectJ, for example, it's very likely that you, as soon as you find out, okay, there's something cross-cutting, that you try to modularize it as an aspect.
Yeah. Is there also aspects in modeling? I mean, I've heard Tom term model weaving.
You could imagine aspects at, as we already talked about, at all levels of artifacts. So if you do, for example, model weaving, you would just express an aspect at the modeling level. The same as, for example, in a programming aspect-oriented programming language, define point cuts in your model and advices, and then weave in the elements. So just the joint point model is different, but you would do the same thing. Basically, you would weave elements into existing models.
And just to disclose, the three of us are currently working on a research project that kind of looks at these things, and we'll maybe have a separate episode about some of these more, let's say, weird or advanced things later. So we just wanted to point this out very briefly. I'm not going to go into too much detail here. Before we look at some AO tools at the end of this episode, or maybe at this second part of a maybe double episode if I look at the clock, one thing we need to discuss briefly are, I think, compile time aspects or developmental aspects. So what is that?
So that's something that's a very good way of starting. So you would then use Aspect J during development of your application, but you wouldn't have it in your production code, for example.
So, but what would it do at development during development time?
So you could, for example, write an aspect that gives you a compiler warning for all your system out print lines you have in your system. So that's very easy to do, and that's very effective.
Uh-huh.
So you could also check for certain architecture constraints.
For example, direct access to private fields from outside. No, stupid. Public fields would
right,
be bad.
Something
maybe.
Like that. Or also when you call, for example, your database layer from your GUI layer.
Oh,
so that's something
okay.
you could check for as well and
oh, nice.
Could then have a compile error, for example, if mm-hmm. somebody would do that.
Because you have a layer violation or something.
That's true. So you could do something like that. And that's a very good starting point for people that use Aspect J for the first time. So maybe they fear of having it in their production code. So they could just use it at development time.
It also might be politically useful if some operational department tells you, some operations department tells you that you cannot have this strange aspect library in your system. You don't have it in the runtime system. You just use it during compilation. And
that's true,
build.
Yeah.
I wonder about one last thing, and that is, if I have a number of aspects that each maybe advise the same join point, how do I mean, is there a way of finding out in which order they apply? I mean, the point is that if I separate out stuff into aspects and then weave it again, then I think that there is a complexity involved in trying to imagine how it will be woven and what the functionality will be, what the consequences are, what the interactions are. How do you get that? How do you challenge or how do you manage that potential complexity?
So in general, you have to, you know yourself or analyze yourself in which order the aspects make sense for mm-hmm. one join point, if there are more than one that target one join point. But then in the aspect language, like in Aspect J, you can express a partial order. So if you want to do, you know, tracing first or tracing last before probably some other aspects changed the parameters, mm-hmm. then you can express a partial order. So one aspect then can dominate another, which means that this aspect has to be taken first. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the ordering of the aspects is what the compiler decides mm-hmm. he wants to do.
It's undefined, basically.
It's more or less undefined. But you have means in Aspect J to do this by defining this partial order, and there are other aspect languages that allow you to define more constraints on the ordering, like the compose star family of aspect compose star family of aspect languages. So there is a lot of research going on in aspect interference. So what influence hence can aspects have on each other? How do I analyze this and how do I solve problems that might arise from the interference of these aspects?
So is AOP a big research topic these days?
It still is a big research topic. In the States, in Europe and in Asia, there are mm-hmm. research communities everywhere dealing with aspect-oriented software development, so going beyond programming.
Mm-hmm.
There are, for example, two big European Commission-funded projects in, mm-hmm. in Europe that deal with this. There are more and more universities who have researchers working on that topic, and it slowly comes also as a teaching topic mm-hmm. into the universities. So yeah. I know a lot of students who already have aspect-oriented programming in some programming course, software engineering courses. So it's getting more and more popular, and it's possible to get people from the universities already who know about aspect-oriented programming.
And how relevant is it in practice for Joe Developer in their real-life projects?
Well, I think there is a group of aspect languages around frameworks like Spring or JBoss, where aspects are used but without the customer knowing about the aspect. So mm-hmm. things like caching mm-hmm. or tracing or logging are implemented as aspects in those frameworks anyway. Mm-hmm. And those frameworks also allow you to define your own aspects. And I think they are quite popular. Mm-hmm. The motivation for aspect J is it's a little bit more you have to do, since you have to convince somebody that you need a new compiler.
Yeah.
And that's probably a little bit harder if you have to convince your project management.
Mm-hmm.
So it, I think aspect J is more currently used at this at groups that are early adopters, that much the majority.
Yeah.
But with the majority, using frameworks like Spring, JBoss AOP, and probably then also this policy injection application block, this enterprise library where it's embedded, for them the barrier is quite low, and I think it's pretty popular there already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so before we wrap this up, let's talk a little bit about some of the tools that are around. We already mentioned a couple of them. So maybe let's start with Aspect J, which is probably the most complete and the most sophisticated, more or less, implementation of AOP for Java, right?
That's true. So it's maybe the most famous one also.
Yeah,
so
yeah. It's the embodiment of AOP.
That's true. So there is lots of tool support for it. So there is a nice Eclipse plugin. You've got lots of views. So you can even, in your base program, you can see in the Eclipse plugin if aspects apply, and if they do, which aspects to apply.
Yeah.
And you can go into your aspect, and you've got syntax highlighting and all those things.
And in case of Aspect J, Aspect J is actually an aspect-oriented language. We have new keywords, I guess. We have a real new expression language for defining point cuts.
That's a language extension to Java, and you need a compiler for that as well.
Yeah, and that's also because the very fine-grained join point model, because it happens on compiler level.
It supports the things we've already talked about, like method call, join points, method execution, things like that.
Yeah. Spring AOP is different there, right?
That's true. So Spring AOP doesn't require you to learn a new language. So it just generates proxies and handles everything within the deployment descriptors.
And the Beans XML.
That's true. So, but in the new version, it also includes the Aspect J point cut syntax.
But fundamentally, the join point model is still the public interface of a bean.
That's true. Yeah.
And you can, in the new version, select these point cuts by using the Aspect J.
By using the Aspect J point cut language, that's true.
Something that I heard was in Aspect J 5 and also in Spring is that you can point cut on attributes, on Java 5 attributes. That's also seems very useful. Like if you have that attribute on a method, then apply some kind of advice.
You can do both things. You can use introductions to even introduce new annotations to classes and methods and also attributes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also in the point cut match then those annotations. So if a certain method is annotated with a special annotation, for example, asynchronous, then you want to implement maybe an aspect that implements asynchronous method invocation and then invokes this method asynchronously.
So, but to some extent, this is, a bit cheating, isn't it? I mean, if I have to annotate a method with something in order for an aspect to trap it, I like this terminology, then what's the point? I mean, I thought the idea was to be able to advise things from the outside without changing the thing you want to advise.
It's very useful if you have, for example, a library of reusable aspects, and you take that library, include it into your project, and then just annotate methods, classes, whatever, with the special annotations, and then the reusable aspects of your library get automatically applied at those points.
Mm-hmm.
So for such a thing, that's very useful.
Mm-hmm. I see, So we talked about Aspect J a bit. We talked about Spring AOP. I think JBoss AOP is very similar to the Spring AOP, I guess, in that you can deploy interceptors on component interface level, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Okay, so we don't need to cover that too much. One thing I'd like to cover before we really wrap up is a more or less researchy language called CSRJ, because I think it has a couple of very interesting features. Specifically, it allows you to use collaborations as aspects. I think you've worked with it. So can you say something about that?
Yeah, so CZJ is a more advanced AO language than AspectJ. So it allows you to define collaborations. So for example, if we again think of the subject observer pattern, if we would implement that in CZJ, we would have different roles, like the role subject and the role observer with the different operations in it, and then you can bind those collaborations to an existing applications.
So that means that a collaboration of a number of objects is reified into its own type. So a collaboration is a type as opposed to classes just being typed. You can have a collaboration.
Yeah,
of those.
That's true.
Yeah. And then of course you can also partially specialize and partially bind those elements of these collaborations.
Right. So you could have some base application. You bind the subject role to a certain class, yeah. And you bind the observer role to a certain class, and then you can delegate the methods. And you've got also the same point cuts available then in AspectJ, for example.
Okay.
What you don't have is introductions, but you don't need them because you implement this functionality as the collaborations, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I also heard that CZJ allows you to dynamically deploy aspects in your program and undeploy them again.
You can instantiate your collaborations as you would instantiate objects in an object-oriented language, and you can deploy them and you can even undeploy them at runtime.
Mm-hmm.
Then
mm-hmm. That's interesting because it allows you. So applying an aspect is not something that applies globally. And you define it during compilation, but rather you can say in that section of the code, I want that aspect to trap the following couple objects. Okay. Any other AO language that we missed to talk about? Maybe a couple of pointers to some research languages.
There are languages like ArrachNet that have features for data flow point cuts. There are languages like CamDAO, which is an aspect-oriented component model.
Mm-hmm.
That also, next to components, has aspects or aspect components that can more or less intercept interfaces for other mm-hmm. components. There are languages that support distribution beyond mm-hmm. What's possible nowadays, like remote point cuts,
mm-hmm.
extensions to .NET languages.
Mm-hmm.
There are other collaboration centric languages like Object Teams. So there is a whole variety and extensions to a whole lot of languages like
of course.
Ruby, Smalltalk.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of languages have. Most of those languages are research languages still. Universities, of course, play around with language extensions a lot. Really, one of those languages really jumps into the industry because still nowadays there are not that many,
too many people who are into this, who are AO experts.
Who are AO experts, and once there are a lot of people who are aware of those aspects, then I think there is a chance for other aspect languages to be used in the industry too.
The usual generational thing, if you want to have a big change in programming philosophy, it takes a generation of developers.
Exactly, it takes about 20 years. And then, so AOP is out there for 10 years now,
mm-hmm.
so there are probably another 10 years to go until they are common in
mm-hmm.
software development.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I haven't forgotten anything really important, then let's wrap this up. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Krista and Iris, for being on the show and making this much more entertaining than if the SE Radio team had tried to come up with that content themselves. Thanks.
Thank you, Markus.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Software Engineering Radio. If you want more information about the podcast and all the other episodes, visit our website at se-radio.net. If you want to support us, you can donate to the SE Radio team via the website, or you can advertise for SE Radio, for example, by clicking on the Dig Reddit Delicious and /dot buttons. To contact the team, please send email to team@seradio.net, or if it's specific to an episode, please use the comments facility on the website so other people can read and react to your comments. This episode of Software Engineering Radio, as well as all other episodes, are licensed under a Creative Commons license. Please see the website for details. Thanks to Charlie Crow and the PodSafe Music Network for the music used in this show. The song is called Vegas Hard Rock Shuffle.